Good afternoon. This is Sarah Sachs with the Brown Political Review. We're sitting down today with Assistant Professor of Political Science, Alex Gourovitch. Thank you so much for sitting down with us today.
Thank you for interviewing.
So welcome to Brown. This is your first year teaching as a professor with us. I know a lot of your research involves political theory and kind of its applications to concepts like labor. I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about how major political thinkers like Locke or Marx might respond to today's levels of unemployment.
Well, I think Locke and Marx would have responded very differently, though maybe not in the ways we would expect. Marx would not have been at all surprised that there are persistent levels of unemployment in our society, because he thought in every capitalist society there's always going to be unemployment. And that is because unemployment serves to repress the bargaining power of existing workers, because they fear they're going to be unemployed or be replaced by the unemployed. And because he thought that the existence of a pool of unemployed workers is necessary for new areas of investment to open up. Capitalists, in order to have new enterprises, need there to be available workers to kind of just immediately be employed once their existing industries become more profitable or once they find new investment opportunities. So he called the unemployed the industrial reserve army of labor. And he thought, while these levels might fluctuate with local circumstances, it's always a part of capitalism and one of its many irrational elements. And partially the reason he thought it was so irrational is because he thought capitalism, on the one hand, invents all these labor-saving technologies, but instead of saving people from having to do work, it throws them out of work. It wasn't just sort of functional to capitalism. It was one of its famous contradictions. It invents labor-saving devices, and by doing that sets them free, but only ironically, in that they don't have any work to do, and therefore are poor and unhappy and alienated. Locke, it's a little bit harder to say what Locke would have said about existing unemployment, because on the one hand, it seems like Locke made a very strong argument for the pre-political moral rights that people have to keep whatever they have legitimately acquired. And that is assumed to mean that if you are a capitalist who acquired your capital correctly, no one has any right to have a job from you, or nobody has any right to take your property or some share of your property so they can employ themselves, and that the whole purpose of government is to protect people's acquisitions. On the other hand, Locke does have these famous conditions that he imposes on the possession and acquisition of property, and one of those mysterious, hard-to-interpret principles is that you can only acquire enough and as good as is left for others. Now, what he meant by enough and as good is unclear, but throughout time there has been a strand of Lockean socialism which says that no one or no group of people should be able to acquire so much land and other means of employment that others are left with no way of finding employment. And so there is a moral requirement on government to make sure that everybody at least has a job and maybe should have some means of production themselves. It's contested, and it's not clear how to interpret this proviso, but we might be surprised that Locke could end up in a certain socialist conclusion about the fact of unemployment.
I know that next spring you're teaching a seminar called Freedom, Work, and Leisure, and in the description it says that it's going to discuss the question of if leisure is the same as idleness. Mm. That really caught my eye. I was wondering if you really describe what that concept means.
Yeah, there are a number of different ways of dividing leisure and idleness. One way is to see leisure as a condition of freedom, whereas idleness as a condition of unfreedom, a situation you're forced through any number of mechanisms, social mechanisms, not to work. So someone who's idle might want to engage in activity but being able to do so, whereas someone at leisure is freely in doing something that's not productive. Another difference between leisure and idleness is that leisure can still be an activity, but it's done for its own sake. It's not done for any end, that end result that it might produce. Whereas idleness is simply a state of inactivity, an unproductive inactivity, or just generally inactivity. Depending on which philosopher you look at, you get different interpretations. Aristotle is the first famous philosopher of leisure as not just idleness, not just a condition in which we're not working, but as a condition in which we're doing some kind of activity for its own sake. So like do philosophy for its own sake in our leisure.
I know right now you're teaching a class on Intro to Political Thought.
Yes.
Which I know they teach kind of an eclectic mix of philosophers. Which is your favorite philosopher to teach and how come?
I think that my favorite philosopher to teach is probably Rousseau, because he identifies so many contradictions that we have to struggle with about the relationship between independence or freedom and happiness, about living in society as a condition of alienation or estrangement, and yet it being also seeming to be our natural or necessary condition. And in his identification of many different solutions to problems we experience as modern people, but also a sensibility to how any of these solutions isn't entirely or clearly satisfying. So today I'm giving a lecture on the social contract, and we'll see the degree to which he thinks that politics can be a solution to our modern condition of estrangement and alienation, and the degree to which, if it is a solution, it's very hard to realize or achieve.
Thank you so much for sitting down with us today. Tune in next Saturday for another Professor Podcast, the Brown Political Review.